The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating, letting people know about the programme. We really do appreciate it. If you'd like to contact us here, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @newstalkscience. Coming up on this week's episode, is life out there? We'll be asking Daniel Oberhaus from Wired, if there are signals in the universe, what might they look like? And whether or not there is a universal language to the universe? Before that, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Shane Bergen and from iCrag, Dr. Fergus McAuliffe. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has today decided to award the 2019 Nobel Prize in Chemistry jointly to John B. Goodenough, M. Stanley Whittingham, and Akira Yoshino.
Is about the Nobel Prize winners, which, shock horror, are all old white men.
Yeah, who knew? So I think this is the only predictable thing you can say about Nobel Prizes in the sciences, is that they're all going to go to old white guys. This one in chemistry actually has gone to the oldest person ever to receive the Nobel Prize. And he has
it's
a great
sort of gaming. Doubling down on the yeah. You know, the rest of the world's like attempt to drag us to a world of equality, isn't it? It's like, no, you know what? We're going to go older and whiter.
I do not like the Nobel Prizes. I think they are a distortion, and I think they don't really live up to what science is about, which is community. But however, they do award things that are scientifically extremely interesting and have huge contributions. And so I looked at the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, which was awarded to three guys, one of whom is called John B. Goodenough, which is, I just hope they picked him because of his name.
Well, I'm not sure what the Nobel criteria is for best chemist in the world, but I'm pretty sure it's not, does his name sound like a 1950s rock and roller? Like, I'm pretty sure there's more strict criteria than that.
This is why we should be on the committee. I it's probably old white guys somewhere in the Nordic countries who were deciding this, and I bet you they didn't even think his name was funny.
Yeah, there you go. It was completely lost on them. Wow. Shows science can be blind. This award was for the discovery of the lithium-ion battery, which basically created the modern world.
Yeah, absolutely. So every portable device that we have has a battery in it, and almost all of them have lithium-ion batteries. That's because they're light, they can be recharged a lot of times, and even though we all freak out about our phones losing charge, when you think about how often you're on your phone, it's probably a couple of hours a day, the fact that it holds its charge for at least 24 hours is incredible. And that's all down to the batteries. And the batteries
So let's do a bit of an explainer. What on earth is a lithium-ion battery?
Okay, so what's a battery is a good question, right? So they're a way of turning chemical energy into electrical energy, right?
Right.
So what does that really mean? So in every battery, if you take out a battery at home, you see there's a plus end and a minus end. And there's also a chemical inside it called an electrolyte. And if you get a new battery, it'll be set up in such a way that you'll have lots of charge at one end, and it'll flow through your circuit, right? And it'll power your light, your phone, whatever. And with a rechargeable battery, you can reverse that process. So instead of sort of electrical charge coming out and powering your device, you can put electricity into it and reset the battery.
Right.
Basically, batteries work by building up what's called a potential difference, or a voltage from the plus end to the minus end. And that is sort of like a potential that pushes the electrons or the current around the circuit. You said before
I'm just looking at you with such a glazed eye because I don't get electricity. It's magic. It doesn't matter how many times you explain it to me, I just don't get electricity.
But if there was one thing that you were to learn about electricity, right, it's the difference between voltage and current.
Okay.
The voltage is the push that you're giving the current through the circuit. That's it, right?
And
so it's current is the juice. It's the electrons. It's the stuff of electricity. It's literally,
what is that?
It's bits of electrical charge. So
that mean?
You have a young child, don't you? No, it is a great question, right? Because this sense of like you need, people say high voltages, they think that's dangerous. Not necessarily. It just means you're pushing a lot, but you may not be pushing at something. So you need a lot of charge to have a high current, which powers things like cookers and stuff like that that need a lot of juice.
So just very briefly, When I plug my kettle in,
yes,
what's traveling down the wire? I mean, we say electricity, right? But what is that? It's particles?
It's electrons, yes, which are particles, and they're flowing through the pipe and they're being pushed with the voltage. So the higher the voltage, the more they're being pushed. The higher the current, the more of the stuff you're pushing.
Okay.
So if you think about it, it's like a water pipe, right? If you have more water in the pipe, you have more current. If there's more force pushing the water, you have more voltage.
I see a TV series in the making right here in Jonathan Learns Electricity. It's probably a 6-season, 12-parter. If you're interested in commissioning, please let me know.
And I'll age.
Anyway, congratulations to the three old white guys who won the Nobel. Fergus, our second story is probably slightly more inspiring, and it is to do with exoskeletons controlled by the mind.
Yes, so this is actually quite a breakthrough of a story. So you never know, down the line, this may in its own right lead to a Nobel Prize. But it all centres around a Frenchman who is in his 30s, and a few years ago he was paralysed when he fell from the roof of a nightclub. But what he has been doing over the last couple of years is working with a team of experts from Grenoble. And what they have done is they have created an exoskeleton, so like a suit that he puts on that allows him to move. So how they did that is they removed two little parts of his skull and replaced them with electrodes. And what those electrodes are doing is they're able to sense and they're able to read the different brain states that he's in. So what happens then is that they then feed that signal into a computer, and this particular patient is sitting in front of the computer and he's controlling an avatar. So he's basically playing a video game. And what he's trying to do is he is trying to get that avatar to move in certain directions. There's an algorithm then that sits in the video game that is learning to recognize what his thoughts are, what his brain states are, and how they are in relation to the movement of the avatar.
So it's sort of machine learning to the message that comes out of its brain.
Exactly.
I can understand this, Shane. It's just electricity.
It is exactly machine learning. And so after 2 years of playing this video game, what they then did was they managed to take what the machine had learned, and then they put the patient into this exoskeleton suit, and this patient thinks about moving left, and slowly the exoskeleton suit will move him left. He thinks of moving right, and the same thing happens.
Because you take the same signals that you use to move the avatar and you put it in a real 3D physical suit.
Exactly. It's the exact same signals. And one of the reasons why this is such a breakthrough is that often when doctors have been trying to help patients that are paralyzed, what they're trying to do is basically stimulate the muscles to get the muscles to move.
Yeah.
Okay. But what we have to remember here is that in a patient that's paralyzed, it's their body that is letting them down. Their brain is still perfectly functional.
Yeah.
So the signals and the thoughts are perfectly functional. And all it's doing is that this exoskeleton is almost replacing the role of the body in moving.
What happens if you get people to wear the suit and you're doing the thinking? Can you control their movement?
Well, if he wasn't in the suit, he would absolutely be able to move this suit on someone could sit in it. Yeah, absolutely.
Just thinking of the military implications for that. Well, I suppose this idea of them all marching together.
I'm sure knowing what the American military have funded over the many years, I'm sure they have thought and tried to do this already. But really interesting. Our third story had to do with meat.
Yes.
But meat in space.
Absolutely. So what happens if you are an astronaut and you fancy a steak, but there are no cows nearby or abattoirs? So you'd need to grow that meat yourself. And thanks to an Israeli company, you can now do that. So
I can see you don't really see the point of this, Shane.
I suppose I'm a latecomer to this sort of synthetic food. I grew up in the countryside. I think food should come from where you come from and should be simple. And it should be grown in the field next to you, ideally.
Okay, yeah, but in space, you can see why this is useful.
Yeah, absolutely. Or if you live in a city even, you may not have the space to do that. And I do understand there are ethical issues when you think of where does all our food come from and who has to make it and how do they live, etc.
Yeah.
It's complex, right? So what they've done is they've taken bovine cells and they have used a 3D bioprinter to make a piece of meat. This 3D bioprinting is incredible, right? So maybe you've covered it before, but they're able to scaffold and make pieces of tissue from cellular beginnings, which is really cool. When I was reading about it, they're actually at the beginning of being able to replicate parts of your body that might have failed, and you won't be able to, no amount of surgery is going to be able to help you. And so there can be small parts of your body that are valves, etc., where they could 3D print a replacement for you. Yeah,
yeah, it's amazing. So with this burger, did they make was it just a few cells, or did they manage to make
It's just a strip
bacon.
Of meat, so I don't think that it would have given any astronaut
nourishment.
No, absolutely, but it was a proof of principle.
But why does space hold particular challenges for that technology, or why were they doing it in space?
The paper didn't really get into that in a great in a lot of detail, but I suppose it is demonstrating that you can produce food in remote places, right? And so if you think about people traveling to perhaps in the distant future to live on the moon, or to go on long distance journeys to Mars, or indeed to live in space for an extended period of time, if you can produce your own food up there, that's hugely beneficial to having the other side, which would be delivering food to you regularly.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the big problems is, of course, once you get a raw burger, someone's got to stick it on the Barbie, and that is probably not something you want to do in the International Space Station.
But you know, I bet you that they would rather make synthetic chicken than just send up a chicken and let that chicken lay eggs.
I don't know where to go with that. So we're going to our final story, Fergus, which is to do with bulls and breeding bulls with no horns.
Exactly. So the bull with no horn has arrived. So this all started in 2016 when a company in the US altered the DNA or the DNA sequence of a bull and managed to give birth to a bull with no horns. So why this is in the news again is because once that bull was mature enough, they took the sperm of that bull and they artificially inseminated a cow. And then they have given birth to another set of offspring, and none of them have horns. So why this is important is because horns on a bull can be quite dangerous to humans, but also the actual process of dehorning or debudding that happens to calves when they're very young is quite painful. So this is a way to get around that. So what they did is they took a short stretch of bacterial DNA and they used that to deliver the genes basically for no horns into this particular bull. Now, why this is important in the broad sense is because they've shown that it works, and they've shown that the offspring are perfectly healthy. And what they've managed to produce is, while these calves are still calves, they're actually genetically modified organisms because they contain this small part of the bacterial DNA that's actually now part of their DNA. And that has huge implications over what they're classified as, because here in the EU, we don't discriminate between the two. So if something is genetically modified, but it's been genetically modified with its own DNA versus the DNA of another species, whereas in the US, they do. So this has long-term implications over whether these particular animals can actually be used as a food source.
Right.
So we do have...
Eat bull? I mean, it's probably Europeans that eat everything, yeah. But I don't know.
But it's the offspring, so, you know. Because horns
aren't. We eat cows.
How do you know that it doesn't do something else when you edit the gene sequence or whatever it's called? How do you know there isn't other unforeseen consequences?
So, well, I guess there's two ways of doing that. One is you check to see if the calves are healthy, but two is they sequence the entire genomes of all of the calves that were born, all six calves, and they all, apart from this one little change, everything else is normal. So this is not the first time this has been done with an animal. So you can eat this thing called the Aqua Advantage salmon in the US, which is the only salmon that has been genetically modified. And
to give you the knowledge...
Yes, it is the Aqua Advantage salmon of knowledge. But personally speaking, I don't know if I would like to eat a salmon that is called the Aqua Advantage salmon.
It doesn't sound very tasty. They've branded it wrong. What's the advantage of this salmon?
The advantage is that it can grow all year round instead of just during spring and summer. Which again, I'd rather eat something natural. That's my own personal taste.
You get into what the definition of natural is, and you know, we've been crossbreeding a whole lot. I mean, you look at a chihuahua, is that a natural thing?
We don't eat them.
No.
We don't eat chihuahuas. But maybe.
I wouldn't eat a whole one.
But maybe all these GMOs are the solution we need if we do want to do all this space travel. So instead of eating that meat, we can eat the
Or reduce the amount of emissions that we have from cow belches. Fergus McCall from iCrack and Shane Bergen, it's been. Interesting. Is there anybody out there in the universe? This is one of those questions that people have asked since people were people. But we've only really started looking in the last 100 years or so with any sort of scientific endeavour. Now, you may have heard of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, the organisation that goes out and looks into the universe to try and find signs. But what does a sign look like? What messages are we sending out there? And what are the chances of either of us being able to understand each other anyway? Well, Daniel Oberhaus is a writer with Wired and author of Extraterrestrial Languages. He joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Daniel. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So this search for extraterrestrials started with Frank Drake in a scientific way, I suppose.
That's right. You know, people have been interested in the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence, as you had mentioned, pretty much since forever. But the modern search for extraterrestrial intelligence started in the mid-20th century with Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, who collaborated on a number of projects. Perhaps the most well-known is Project OSMA, which was run out of the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia in the United States. And they observed two stars for several months, several hours a day. They didn't hear anything, but, you know, it kind of got the ball rolling. And, you know, people have been observing ever since.
Sorry, they did what?
They tuned a giant radio telescope to two stars about a dozen light years away from Earth, and they listened for several hours a day. They just had a long sheet of paper scrolling, and there was a needle just moving back looking for a spike in radio energy. Yeah.
And so they found nothing over how long?
It was about 4 months, and they were sitting there several hours a day. And, you know, Drake, when he was reflecting on it a few years later, just described it as one of the most excruciatingly boring pastimes ever, which, you know, when you're hunting for aliens, isn't exactly what you would expect.
No, yeah, Alien Hunters as a movie, you don't imagine just a man in a room looking at a piece of paper and a needle not moving. So before radio became a big thing, there were a number of scientists in Europe who were trying to contact Martians. Isn't that right?
Yeah, of course. So one of the more interesting ideas, I think, was there was an Austrian astronomer named Joseph von Littrow, who had the idea that it would be great to dig massive trenches in the Saharan desert, fill them with water, coat them with kerosene, and light them on fire so we could send giant flaming messages to people that they thought might live on the moon or, you know, perhaps more likely Mars.
What was the message? Our planet is on fire?
Yeah, I mean, that would definitely send a pretty strong signal. I mean, he was looking more at mathematical signals. So for instance, something you could create a visual proof of the Pythagorean theorem or something of that nature. So relatively simple messages. But in Paris, around, you know, the mid-19th century, they started thinking about how to send more complex messages. So, for instance, one mathematician came up with an idea to coat the Eiffel Towers in giant mirrors and use them to flash Morse code signals towards Mars. You know, I'm not sure how he expected the Martians to know Morse code because it's entirely conventional, but it was a slight improvement over lighting the desert on fire.
And I love the fact that, like, the Eiffel Tower was the tallest thing a Parisian could come up with. So those sort of early efforts were probably inspired by the desire to understand where we stood in the universe. But at that time, were people thinking whether or not it was a good idea? Had the 1950s idea of if aliens come, they're going to kill us been publicly talked about?
You know, that's interesting. The idea of these malevolent aliens existing out there, it, you know, maybe in some obscure science fiction, but it wasn't really until Marconi and Tesla started experimenting with radio around the turn of the century that people really kind of started to take those ideas seriously, because radio could communicate across much greater distances than light. And there's a great anonymous editorial from the New York Times from like 1903, where this person is making the argument that, you know, we shouldn't use radio to contact aliens. Marconi is nuts, because if they have more advanced math than us, they're just going to ruin everything for us on Earth. We need to figure this out on our own. You know, let's not talk to them. You know, I think that was really the first part in my research that I found that where people really started taking the idea of contact seriously and, you know, considering the downsides.
So we are nowadays trying to look for signals, and we'll talk about, you know, sending signals out in a while. But we are looking for signals coming in. What looks like an alien signal to us, do you think?
I mean, that is the big question for astronomers who are involved in SETI. Depending on who you ask, you'll get a different answer. So, for instance, out at the SETI Institute in Northern California, they look for a handful of parameters when they're searching for signals. One of them is that the signal only occupies a narrow bandwidth. So if you're looking at a pulsar or something out in the universe, the radio waves it emits will kind of be just smeared across the radio spectrum.
Right.
Whereas for an intelligent signal, you'd expect that they would concentrate the energy in a very narrow bandwidth. And so that would be a great sign of a signal, as would be a repeating pattern, you know, maybe in something simple like an on-off, on-off pattern.
Mm.
So pretty rudimentary stuff. But since we haven't discovered anything, you kind of have to take your best guess. Like, how would we send a message out into the universe? And so that's kind of the same, the tack we've taken when we've broadcast.
So have we seen signals out there in space that are as yet unclassified?
We definitely see a lot of unclassified signals in space. Lately, the radio astronomy community has been very interested in these events called fast radio bursts, which are these huge peaks in radio intensity that last for just a few microseconds.
Mm.
And no one can really explain them yet. The current thinking is that they're natural phenomena, not aliens. But, you know, if you're interested in extraterrestrial life, a few decades ago, astronomers out at Ohio State University discovered a signal that to this day remains our best candidate for an extraterrestrial signal. It's generally known as the WOW signal. And they saw this kind of ramp up in energy on this radio band that they were monitoring, and still can't explain this kind of slow increase and then decrease in energy. There wasn't any information encoded in the signal, which I think makes it a little bit suspect as a candidate signal, but we've never seen anything else like it before or since. So
what do you mean information encoded in the signal?
So in this particular case, the signal was unmodulated radio wave. So if I were to send, say, a Morse code message to you, I would modulate the signal, which just basically means changing its parameters. So either I could switch between two frequencies, or I could change the intensity of the single frequency itself.
Mm.
And by changing those in predetermined patterns, such as Morse code, you would be able to encode information into the signal. And so in this case, it was just there was no modulation. It was just the same radio frequency, just getting more powerful and then less powerful over the course of about a minute and a half.
Maybe that was a modulation that became more powerful and less powerful. Perhaps that they're doing isn't as concrete.
Well, and you know, to that point, you know, a lot of people in SETI, especially people who are thinking about broadcasting messages out into the universe rather than just searching for them, think that the most energy efficient way to do that would be just to create a beacon. So you just, you know, don't put any information in there, just send out a signal, and that could alert an ETI to our presence, and then maybe we can begin a conversation.
So there are a few sort of candidates, but nothing very convincing at the moment, and nothing, certainly we haven't seen any little green men, or at least not that the CIA has let us hear about. But are we sending any signals out? I mean, I know Voyager, the spacecraft, was sent 40 odd years ago. That's still traveling, but as far as I'm concerned, it's still either in our solar system or just a little bit beyond, but it's certainly not going any distance to somewhere where we think there might be extraterrestrial life. Do we send out signals that go to another solar system, and who's doing that and why?
So as you had mentioned, the odds of anyone picking up Voyager are next to zero. Actually, there was a message that predated Voyager that was created by Carl Sagan and Frank Drake that they sent from the Arecibo message, but that also, even though it is the most powerful message we've ever sent to space ever, that also isn't likely to be received, much less understood, by an extraterrestrial intelligence, just due to the distances involved as well as the coding scheme. But we've gotten a little bit more sophisticated in terms of how we think about messaging today. It's still a really controversial area of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. There's a very strong contingent of astronomers who think it's a waste of time, money, and perhaps, you know, could be a dangerous activity to pursue. But there are some people that are, you know, actively pursuing this. One that immediately comes to mind is a quite well-known astronomer named Douglas Backuk, who runs the METI Institute. And he, for the last 2 years, has actually broadcast a message each year from a radio telescope up in Norway. And this message was actually pretty unique. It was based on the most recent scientific message that had been sent before, which was in 2003. And so they kind of pulled some of the design elements from that message. And then they worked with a bunch of musicians from the Sonar Music Festival, which is an annual festival in Spain. And they had a bunch of musicians design short little musical messages. And they're all very, very creative and very unique in their approach to this. You know, will anyone hear this? The answer, you know, we won't know for a few years, but...
How far can this message travel?
That's actually a big point of contention with these messages. There's a lot of people who think that they weren't actually strong enough to be received by their target, but their target does, we know for a fact that the target hosts an exoplanet that is in the habitable zone. So there is the possibility that there could be life, whether or not it's intelligent, you know,
yeah,
it's kind of a long shot, but there is a planet at their target. It's just a question of, is there anyone listening there?
So these messages, are they so precise as to be able to target a single planet or a solar system or a galaxy or what?
So in this case, it would be a solar system. So, you know, if someone were to send a message towards our sun with the ability of our radio receivers on Earth, we would most likely be able to detect it unless there was some unusual circumstance given the position of the planet relative to the sender or something like that. And, you know, the sun, our own sun. But yeah, by targeting solar systems, there's a pretty good chance that if there was someone on a planet there, they would be able to
pick it
hear
up. What about AI? How much of the sky are we scanning? And can AI not surely answer this question for us very quickly? Or is that still a staggering amount of data to have to compile and analyze?
So one of the holy grails for SETI is to basically put enough receivers over the surface of the Earth so that we can be scanning all the sky all the time. We're not quite there yet. That takes a lot of money and a lot of, you know, smart people working on the problem, and SETI is always strapped for cash. But, you know, at this point, we have run about 50 SETI surveys covering thousands and thousands of stars. But one of the senior astronomers working with the SETI Institute likes to kind of make the comparison that if the universe was all of the oceans on Earth, we've only searched for about a hot tub or a jacuzzi's worth of that ocean for life. So barely scratching the surface here. Mm. But as you had mentioned, artificial intelligence, I think, is a very promising research direction for this because it can look, it can basically average over all of the readings from these telescopes looking for intelligent life and say, you know, what is the norm and what looks unnormal? And this might be very small deviations from the norm that might escape human notice, but it can pick out these little small little blips on the radar essentially and say, hey, maybe we should look closer at this signal and we might have missed that otherwise. And so SETI is really just kind of getting started with AI, but I think over the next 10 years, you know, advances in computing plus advances in radio telescopes, I don't think it's too far-fetched to think that within our lifetime, if there are extraterrestrials broadcasting, we might be able to hear them.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea, but the numbers to me sound very much stacked against us. But it would be spectacular to find alien life on Mars, which I know is one of the next missions that NASA has. It would be amazing to look at an exoplanet and see some sort of a signal that let us know that actually Earth is all across our universe. But I think the likelihood of that is, as you say, a hot tub in all the oceans in the world or a needle in a haystack, but it doesn't mean we should stop looking. Daniel Oberhaus, writer with Wired and author of Extraterrestrial Languages. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Love to know what you make of that. And you can tell us. That's the nature of communication. So if you'd like to email us, science@newstalk.com. It's hard coming up with new ways of doing that, Aidan. Caused Aidan to snort a little out of his nose, which is slightly disturbing. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or find us on Twitter. We're at @newstalkscience. As evidence of the fact that we do read your submissions, here's some of your tweets and texts from last week. We were talking about bird brain manipulation and the idea that if you select some brain cells within a bird's brain, and you use optogenetics, which is using light to trigger activity in the brain, you can actually implant the memory of a bird song that they've never heard before, and then the birds can actually go on and sing that song, which is amazing. Pat and Oren Moore says you could use the brain implant method used on birds to implant the memory in your listeners that you won a gold at the IMROs too. Oh, come on, Pat. Oh, he's nice. He says, I think you should have. Well, that's very kind of you. But actually, this year was good, but I wasn't. Sometimes I'm like, I always say we're going to lose because I'm superstitious that way. But sometimes I think we might win. This year, I really didn't think we were going to win. And then we definitely didn't win because we got bronze, which is not even the number one loser. So I'm fine about it. Anyway, it would have been 10 international or national radio awards over 10 years. You would have heard about that probably for the rest of my life. It was within a hair's breadth, and now it's gone. And I'll never be able to say that. 9 out of 10, it sounds shit. So
you certainly seem fine about it.
I'm so fine. Are there any other awards we can enter between now and December that we have any chance of winning that would allow me to say 10 out of 10? No.
But okay. Golden Globes are before the end of the year, aren't
Golden
they?
Globes, yeah. Someone says, we're talking about AI, and someone says, imagine every question ever asked by humanity. Imagine all the answers ever given by sentient humans to these questions. Knock up a spreadsheet, sprinkle in some algorithms, work the numbers, and you have AI. In fact, this is the technique used by some AI engines to present back likely answers for chatbots. So this is constant competitions going on in the AI world to beat the Turing test, which is to have a conversation with a human and a machine, and for the coders to be so convincing with their chatbot to program a computer so well that a person behind a screen wouldn't know if they were chatting to a human or a computer. And so far we've been rubbish at that. But some of the attempts to create a chatbot in that environment actually use that idea of a technique, which gives you a sort of schizophrenic AI, but in some contexts that could work really, really well. And then finally, we had a great episode. One of my favorite ones about animals was the Crypt Keeper Wasp episode in your gold episode, the last one in your feed. Lots of people texting in about it. Connor says, really hope you plan to get Kelly Wienersmith back on the program. He was talking about this, and it's fascinating science. I had sort of forgotten, because at the end of a program, you always say, oh, we must talk to you again. And then you, much like meeting a friend on holiday, completely ignore them for the rest of your life. But let's try and get Kelly Wienersmith back on, if only to be able to say Kelly Wienersmith. That's it from us. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Producer was Aidan McKelvey. On sound with Giorgio Cardozo. Simon Keane was researching. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed. Find it where you found this. In the meantime, stay curious.